Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our past programs at radioinvivo.net. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Hamner Centers for Health Sciences in Research Triangle Park. The Hamner is a renowned leader in environmental health sciences research and education. For more than 25 years, the Hamner has contributed science that guides sound regulatory decisions and protects the health of the public. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Hamner for its support. And Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. NESENT's mission is to facilitate broadly synthetic research to address fundamental questions in evolutionary biology by providing an environment for fertile interactions among scientists. Radio In Vivo and WCOM thank NESENT for its support. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, the NCABR has been fulfilling its mission to promote public understanding and support for bioscience research and careers. To learn more about the benefits of bioscience for the future of North Carolina, visit NCABR's homepage, www.ncabr.org, and its clearinghouse of bioscience resources, www.aboutbioscience.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research for its support. And last but not least, we are thrilled to welcome yet another underwriter to the WCOM and Radio In Vivo family. Radio In Vivo is now also underwritten by the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Moorhead's monthly Current Science Forums series presents expert speakers and lively discussions of today's science headlines. Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center is online at moorheadplanetarium.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center for its support. Well, it is especially appropriate to welcome the Moorhead Planetarium and Science Center aboard this week because my guest is a gentleman who was recently featured as the speaker at one of Moorhead's current science forums that we just mentioned. The topic at that forum was, is HPV vaccination a good idea? And that's an issue we're going to explore for ourselves here on Radio In Vivo today. Dr. Noel Brewer is an assistant professor of health behavior and health education at the UNC School of Public Health. He received a BA in economics from University of California at Santa Cruz and an MS and his PhD in psychology from Rutgers University. All of that has added up to a research interest in the psychology of medical decision-making, including why people feel at risk and when those beliefs motivate health protective behavior. Noel, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you.
To get us started, why don't you kind of set the scene for us in terms of the HPV vaccination, in case there are folks out there who haven't heard too much about this controversy?
Sure. There's a new vaccine that's been developed. In fact, one of the companies working on this here in the Triangle. And they, the vaccine, or at least there's a whole family of vaccines, but the one that's currently been approved is by a company named Merck. And this vaccine is highly effective in preventing infection with HPV. And HPV is a virus that causes cervical cancer. And it causes a bunch of other bad things as well, but cervical cancer is one of the things that we're most concerned about. And the vaccine, the current one on the market called Gardasil, prevents 70% of the HPV infections, meaning that we're probably going to prevent 70% of these cervical cancers. The exact numbers are a little unclear. So that's the good news. The bad news, though, is that the controversy about, there are various controversies about potential side effects of the vaccine, cost, effects on other behavior.
I see. Well, regarding the vaccine itself, Noel, how effective is it? You say it will prevent roughly 70%?
Yeah, the current estimates right now are that the... Well, actually, let me back up for just a second. HPV has a lot of different types to it, a lot of different subtypes. And so HPV 16 and 18 happen to cause cervical cancer. There are other things that cause cervical cancer as well, other types of HPV that this vaccine doesn't address. So the vaccine right now appears to stop infection with about 70% of the oncogenic or cancer-causing kinds of HPV. And that's good news. The bad news, of course, is that there's still another 30% that don't seem to be addressed by the vaccine.
Sure. And are those cervical cancers also typically caused by strains of HPV?
Yeah, we believe that cervical cancer is only caused by HPV. And there are a couple different subtypes, but 16 and 18 are two of the most common, but there's a couple other types that are slightly less common.
I see. And this is strains of the virus itself, as we see with seasonal flus and avian flus and things like that, right?
Right. Those are different viruses that have different characteristics to them, but it's the same idea. These are viral infections. They're things that you get from other people.
I see. Well, is it too soon? I mean, this vaccine has been out for a while now. What, a few years it's been on the market at this point?
It's been on the market for about a year and a half.
Oh, is that all? Just a year and a half. Well, is it too soon at this point to be able to discern any kind of downward trend in the incidence of cervical cancer, which, of course, takes many years to develop?
Yeah, I think it certainly is too soon to be able to say that this vaccine is having an effect on the population in the United States. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that cervical cancer takes a long time to develop. Another reason is that the vaccine hasn't been all that widely adopted. Mm-hmm. Our data suggests that at most maybe 10 or possibly 20% of people in rural North Carolina are getting this vaccine, and maybe at most 10% in the urban areas.
I see. And does that reflect national trends?
We don't know, actually. The data that I just mentioned are data we haven't published yet, and there are no data that are available on national uptake. The most recent data are something like half of 1%, but that's not all that reliable and is somewhat old. Those are the CDC's data.
I see. I was going to ask, is this something the CDC is monitoring?
Yeah, they're monitoring in a big way, but unfortunately you can only ask so often. So the next data to come out, I think, doesn't come out for a couple months.
I see. Well, tell us a little bit more about the safety profile of the vaccine and its track record in its clinical trials.
Sure. One of the things I think might be helpful is, first of all, to talk about just what the vaccine does.
Sure.
And the vaccine prevents infection with HPV, but it doesn't necessarily directly prevent cancer. So it prevents cancer indirectly by preventing HPV infection. So all of these great studies that we have right now, these really amazing studies that the whole scientific world has sort of sat up and taken notice of, are about preventing cervical cancer, and yet there's not a single study that shows that the HPV vaccine prevents cancer. What we have shown is that it prevents the precursors to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So it also might be helpful to know a bit about how cervical cancer gets going. Essentially,
sure.
What happens is that there is this HPV infection, then some sort of abnormalities develop, and there's a sort of a long stage of abnormalities that develop over time. And I could give some technical names for them that are probably not as important as understanding that it takes...
Those are precancerous.
Exactly.
Abnormalities.
Well, there's just abnormalities, and they become precancerous, and they become cancerous, and they become invasive cancer. So there's all these different stages, and this is an unusual cancer because it takes so long to develop. Another thing that makes it unusual is that we can intervene at very early stages. So women go and get pap smears every year because of cervical cancer. They're trying to detect these early cervical abnormalities. And another reason for getting the pap smear is not only to detect the abnormalities, you can treat it easily at these early stages.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the implications of that is that cervical cancer, for the most part, is a completely preventable disease. This is something that shouldn't exist anywhere in America or anywhere in the world because we know how to find it, we know how to treat it. And there may be some cases, there just may be some where we will never be able to detect it in time, that some particularly invasive kinds of cervical cancer, powerfully developing ones. But that's not how we think about it right now in terms of prevention. We believe that it is a fully preventable cancer. So now the question is, what does this new science tell us about treating cancer or intervening before people develop cervical cancer? The studies all show that you can reduce the incidence dramatically of these precursors, these things that happen in women's cervices directly before they go on to develop full-blown cervical cancer. But right now we only have the data on those preliminary types, but it's so powerful and so persuasive that we really believe that this is going to stop cervical cancers. But your question that got this whole sort of train of thought going was, what is the safety profile of this vaccine? So we know a bit about what the benefit is, but we don't know the long-term benefit yet, and we don't know yet how many cervical cancers will be stopped in the population at large. It will take 20, 40 years to really know that number.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, with the safety, we know a little bit about what the short-term side effects are, but we don't know much about long-term side effects. In fact, we know nothing at all. And that's one of the big debates, is whether or not it's ethical to jump in and go and start giving this vaccine to everyone, given the possibility of long-term side effects that are unknown.
Right.
The people who know about these vaccines and think carefully about them have made that decision that, yes, this is a good decision for Americans to do, that on balance, we think at the level of the population, this is what we should do for population health.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But when it comes to a particular mom and a particular daughter, this is a decision that they have to make on their own. That they can take the good advice of the CDC and the other panels who make these decisions, but it really is their decision. And I think at this point, it is fair to say this is an open decision. It's not a foregone conclusion that you must do this.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of other childhood vaccines where there is no question that you really, really should go and get those vaccines, even though there are debates about whether vaccination is good or bad.
Sure.
This is in a slightly different stage where it's an open question. And there are other ways to prevent cervical cancer. There is pap smears and there's sexual abstinence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are there any other adverse effects of the human papillomavirus itself?
Thank you. And I didn't pick up the short-term side effects. What we know about the short-term side effects essentially is that there are some of the usual things that may be feeling a little fluish for a day or two, and some soreness at the site of the injection. I can say anecdotally in talking to people, what's described as some soreness in the arm is really understating it, that the people I've heard from, again, this is just anecdotal, not based on scientific evidence, is that the side effects are pretty substantial,
right,
meaning that it's mm-hmm. your arm is really sore. It's not just like a flu shot where it's a little sore for a couple days. Some people have a more profound reaction where it's extremely sore, maybe a little hard to move even for 3 or 4 or 5 days.
I see. Well, what I was actually getting at, though, is the virus itself, does it have any other clinical adverse effects? Or is it simply...
I see your point.
Ultimately, so, the cervical cancer is the only
bad
thing that happens.
Sure. So what does HPV do to people? It does a whole bunch of miserable things. Cervical cancer is one of the ones that kills people, but of course there's also genital warts. Genital warts are caused by HPV.
Mm-hmm.
Warts on your hands, warts on your feet, that's caused by HPV. Different kinds, not necessarily the cancer-causing kinds. Remember, there's 50 or 100, 150 different kinds of HPV out there. There are other cancers, though, that are caused. Oropharyngeal cancer, the cancer of the throat and the mouth. Certain kinds of that are related to HPV, although less directly than cervical cancer. Cervical cancer is caused by HPV and nothing else, so far as we know.
Mm-hmm.
But oropharyngeal cancer seems to have other causes as well.
Okay.
There's also penile cancer and anal cancer. Those are other ones. And so we think of this right now as being a vaccine to help women. But guys out there, pay attention.
Right.
And also, in terms of that, there's a debate out there about whether or not we should vaccinate men, and also whether or not we should vaccinate boys.
Right. Well, that was actually my next question about why, at this point, it's only approved for and being administered to girls. So it seems like it would potentially also be an effective public health measure for boys to get it as well.
Yeah, I think about guys as the vectors of disease here.
So do a lot of the girls.
yeah, that for the most part, this is heterosexual transmission, so the girls are getting it from boys. And, of course, boys are getting it from girls. It goes on and on. But mm-hmm. the immediate threat for women is not other women, it's men. So that there is good reason to think about vaccinating both men and women. The problem is the cost effectiveness. I think that was one of the decisions they made early on, was that if you could really only afford to vaccinate boys or girls, then you would probably choose to vaccinate the group that has the greater disease burden, which is women. So you can mm-hmm. help them out immediately first. A second issue is that the decision-making group within the CDC is very conservative. And they look very, very carefully at a very narrow kind of data. And I should also throw in the FDA there.
Mm-hmm.
So our federal
mm-hmm.
approval process is much more conservative than in some other countries.
So is that the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices?
That's exactly right, the ACIP.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue here is that they're a little conservative about it. Let me back up for a second. The FDA approves the drug and the ACIP, or the vaccine in this case, and then the ACIP, which is part of the CDC, they go on to say, well, now that it's approved, who do we think ought to get it? And then the government comes up behind that and says, all right, now let's try to figure out how to pay for it, given that it's recommended. Mm-hmm. All right. That's here in America. So we have our own American healthcare system, which is good in many ways and not good in other ways. But it's also this whole drug approval process is really, really conservative. In other countries, though, they've already moved on and said, let's vaccinate everyone. Australia, 80% of people are vaccinated there. 80% of youth are, at least. So they're vaccinating both boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And they're not at all concerned about that. As far as they're concerned, the data, which was collected only on adolescent girls and young women, should be just as effective for men. They believe that it should be equally effective, and they made that leap in their logic. They also may have some sense of what the preliminary data show for boys, and my sense is that it shows that it's also effective. Mm-hmm. The other thing then is that, you know, see, Australia is an example. There's also European countries who are vaccinating boys and men also. Another thing I'll throw out there, though, is that for listeners who are considering whether or not they want to have a son vaccinated, you can have him vaccinated today. That there's something called off-label usage.
Sure.
That any drug that is approved by the FDA can be used for whatever other purpose. So you can walk into your physician and say, I'd like to have my son vaccinated. That's acceptable. And, of course, it's your decision, and that's all up to you. But mm-hmm. it's not something the ACIP currently recommends. But my guess is that in the future they will.
Have you heard about any families doing that?
I have not heard about that yet. I think in I'll take that back. Yes, one person talked to me about it.
Okay. Well, is there any directly motivating factor for a family to make that decision for a 11 or 12-year-old boy, since it's not necessarily going to prevent any disease in the boy?
Yeah, boys don't have cervices, so they can't really get cervical cancer. Yeah, yes, I understand that. There are other things, though, as well. Certainly the genital warts is an issue. One of the vaccines that's out, the one that's out right now at least, prevents genital warts, a good amount of them, about 90% of genital warts. So that's a good reason. And also, maybe this is a good thing for all the girls that the boy may come in contact with later in his life, his wife at some point. I mean, of course, you know, if he's gay, then also that protects his partners.
Absolutely.
And him.
Noel, how long does this protection with the existing vaccine last, or has that even been determined? Right now, in the approved versions, is a booster required at some point in time?
Those are all great questions, and I think the clearest answer is we don't know.
Okay.
We know that the vaccine seems to last powerfully for maybe 5 or 7 years. We don't have data that go much longer than that. My guess from looking at the nature of these trials and the powerful immunogenic effect of this vaccine is that it'll go on for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're getting like 100% protection or 99.9, depending on how you count the data. I mean, so this is a great vaccine, likely to last a long time. There are some of these other vaccines that are coming out that may last longer. It's hard, though, to sort through the drug company spin that one drug company is coming out with a vaccine that doesn't protect against genital warts, just the cervical cancer type. So it's protecting against two types of HPV instead of four.
Okay.
And so that company is saying, well, no, ours doesn't cover genital warts, but hey, it's going to last longer. Hmm. It's going to be more powerful because it's more targeted, and they have some data that suggests that. I really don't know at this point. I think we're just at the level of spin when you get there. Mm-hmm. But it does look like that it's going to be pretty long lasting, and right now there's no recommendation for boosters.
I see. Okay. One of the issues I've seen discussed in some of the literature is about the use of the vaccine in older women. Right now the recommendation is that girls age 11 to 12 is really the ideal time for them to get it, and possibly even as young as 9. And it's also recommended, apparently, for 13 to 26-year-old girls and women who have not yet received or completed the whole series of three shots. What do you know about the potential use of this vaccine in older women?
That's a great question. Let me address this who should get vaccinated first in terms of the age ranges. Then we'll talk about the people outside those age ranges.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So they did this sort of weird thing where they have these three categories that you just alluded to. You got the 9 to 10-year-olds, the 11 to 12-year-olds, and then you got the 13 to 26-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
So because there's only so much money running around to pay for all of this, they couldn't very well say, go and vaccinate everyone. We couldn't afford it. It's something that, I mean, this is a very expensive vaccine.
Right.
And I think that weighed into their decision. So what they said is, 11 to 12-year-olds, get them vaccinated tomorrow immediately. Everyone, do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then for the 13 to 26-year-olds, do follow-up or sort of get them when you can. So it's recommended for them. They certainly should do it, all 13 to 26-year-old women and girls, but do it when you can. And then sort of as an option, 9 to 10-year-olds, whatever, for whatever motivation you may have. Maybe this is the one chance you'll have to get them vaccinated. Who knows? They didn't talk about vaccinating younger kids because we don't have any data on younger kids yet. In terms of safety, but also I think they want to get the kids as close to their sexual activity as possible, given that we only know that this lasts for 5 or 7 years. If you give it to mm-hmm. a two-year-old and then it wears off after 7 years and you have to re-inoculate them at 9 years old and you've sort of wasted money and resources.
Sure.
So probably this, like other similar vaccines that were started out as adolescent vaccines, will move earlier in ages over time. A good analogy is the hepatitis B vaccine, which was rolled out here in North Carolina to a similar age kids. All kids in school got it, and then it slowly moved now to like a you know, something you give to kids when they're very young.
Mm-hmm.
But your question was about older adults. So what do you do about women who are 26 and older? There's data that's going to be coming out pretty soon that shows that it does help them. So certainly 26 to 40-year-old, that's a viable range.
And many of whom, you know, obviously are going to theoretically pretty much all have been sexually active by that point, and a large number of whom will already be infected with HPV.
Yeah, and that raises a...
Since so many people are.
Yeah, that raises a related issue. There's so many things that we know about this vaccine, and there's so many still that we don't. What we know is that the vaccine doesn't help you if you've already been infected with one of these types.
Really?
Meaning, okay. If you've had 16, it's not going to prevent you from developing the type 16 cancer.
I see. So it's not a therapy then.
Exactly. It's not a therapy for women who are already infected.
Okay.
That still leaves open the possibility. Maybe you got the HPV-16, but you haven't had the HPV-18 yet.
Mm-hmm.
And because we don't have good tests for what you've had in the past, we go ahead and recommend women just go ahead and get it. We know what you have right now, what's active, but it's possible, meaning we could do a blood test on a woman and find out, looking for DNA particles, what kind of HPV she does or does not have active in her system. But what we don't know is if those DNA types can resolve on their own and sort of disappear, and then what the next part of the story is. If you don't have an active infection, so if you've had one, it's gone away,
mm-hmm.
now
mm-hmm.
does the vaccine help you in the future?
We don't really know the natural history of the progression from infection with the virus to ultimately to disease.
Yeah. That part we do. We know the natural. That's the part we've done a really good job on for the last 20 years is sorting out the natural history.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't know though is what happens after resolution. So we know is what happens when you get infected and it gets worse and worse and worse and worse. But that slightly other pathway where you get infected and then it naturally resolves, which most infections do. Most of these HPV infections just go away on their own. What's the next step? Can you get it again? And mm-hmm. I don't know what the answer to that is, and there may be a scientist out there who has a better answer.
Okay. Well, let's get into some of the social and legal issues involved, because there are many. Kind of to get us started on that section, Noel, what is the current legal situation overall regarding the HPV vaccination? Are any states requiring it, and where are we in North Carolina, and how did things turn out in Texas?
Good question. So these are sort of legal and policy questions, and what's sort of underneath your question is this sort of debate that happened in Texas.
Mm-hmm. That's where it all became a lightning rod.
So what happened is that the governor of Texas, I think, mandated that all school kids would get this vaccine, and all hell broke loose in Texas. And so the governor actually rescinded his own order.
Yeah, Governor Perry.
Right. And they changed their mind. They said, okay, it'll be optional now.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of other states were planning similar laws that they were going to mandate it, make it available and mandate it. And when it was revealed that Merck, the company that was making the vaccine, or that makes Gardasil, the one that's currently on the market, was funding many of these, or sort of pushing or lobbying for many of these laws, mm-hmm. that pretty much all the states backed up.
Big surprise there.
Yeah, which is, I think, a good decision. I don't think having these drug companies deciding on laws is good. Whether or not the laws are good, that's a whole separate issue, and that can be taken up.
Sure.
I think the laws probably were good laws, but having them decided by drug companies, I don't think is a good idea at all.
Indeed. Well, one of the things I found very interesting in looking into this, particularly in terms of the legal situation like that, is that apparently there's a precise legal definition in this arena of the word compulsory. That compulsory doesn't mean what we think of as compulsory, because many states have been considering making the vaccine compulsory, but giving parents the option to opt out, which of course isn't really compulsory, but shifts the onus for action from the state to the individual. So the state is making the population mm-hmm. level decision, but the individual mm-hmm. can, in fact, say no if they so choose.
Well, there's a couple issues here, and one of them is I do want to just bring this up again about the drug companies being behind these laws. I think that the reaction was way too strong. I have a similar reaction, but we've mm-hmm. thrown the baby out with the bathwater here. Whether or not the drug companies were behind it, it doesn't make it any better or worse a law. And so we can still reevaluate these laws and decide they're probably really good laws. They're probably good ideas. One of the things and I'll get back to the issue of compulsory HPV vaccination in particular, but one of the things we know is that when you set a default, that has a powerful influence on behavior. And I'll give you the example of organ donation. Mm-hmm. There's a nice paper by Eric Johnson and Dan Goldstein in Science a couple of years ago looking at organ donation and whether or not it's the default behavior. And they compared a bunch of European countries. And in European countries where the default is to not donate your organs, which is how it is here in the United States, the rates of organ donation were somewhere between, say, 1% and 10%. One exception was Holland, where they're so completely pro-social in every possible way. They had a national campaign. They did everything you possibly could do. They got up to 25%.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The other countries where you had the default was to opt out, meaning that when you passed away, your organs would be donated to help save another person's life. And then if you signed a form or did whatever, then your organs wouldn't be donated. The rates were around 99%, 98%, completely not overlapping except for one country again. This one was Sweden. And Sweden, for whatever reason, got down to 87%.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
these are completely unrelated phenomena in a way that you have 10% and you have 90%. They're not overlapping. They're completely distinct.
Sure.
We have a similar thing playing out here in the United States right now around HPV vaccine. We have 10%, maybe 20% if you squint, look sideways, and look carefully, great. Australia's at 80%. They have default provision. They're just simply providing the vaccines in schools, no fuss, no muss, you move on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We're going to have more people getting cervical cancer and dying because we're not doing default provision. Now, I still think it's a decision that parents should want to weigh. I'm at that point of still thinking that this is something that's a personal decision. But as a policymaker, I think the policy that we should adopt is clear, that we should be providing the vaccine and then asking parents if they don't want to provide it.
Right now what's happening is just that information is going out. Is that correct? I understand that's the situation in North Carolina.
Within the state, that's exactly right. The state legislature, in their wisdom, decided that it was important that we get something out there for kids and parents in North Carolina. They couldn't afford the $11 million that it was going to cost to vaccinate all 11- and 12-year-olds. They just didn't have the money for that.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, they made the decision instead to have education done. And so the folks at the North Carolina Immunization Branch put together a really great flyer. It's a 2-page color flyer that is required to be distributed through all schools. But it stopped there. So the law said that this must be sort of sent out, but it never put money for supporting it, and it never gave a mechanism for it. So this flyer mm-hmm. has now been provided to all the schools, and the schools decide if they will distribute it, how they will distribute it. That's our entire HPV vaccination policy in North Carolina at the present.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can do better.
It certainly sounds that way. So the parent getting the information with that 11- to 12-year-old girl what are they looked at to do at that point? Are they required, if they decide that this is a good option, to contact their own physician and
Then the game begins. Now you got to go find the person who's got the vaccine, and that's not so easy. We've been doing some studies on HPV vaccine provision by talking to providers in rural areas, and there are a lot of them that don't have it. Maybe 75% of the places we talked to had the vaccine. That's still 25% that don't. There's issues around vaccine coverage. Who am I as a person wanting the vaccine? Can I afford it?
Right.
There's a big issue with this vaccine around money. It's three doses, first of all, which makes it hard. You got to get one dose, then a month later or 2 months later, you get the second dose, and then you get the last one at the six-month point. But it's $120 a dose.
Right.
So you add all that up, $360, and some places charge more than that. If your insurance covers it, great, but many people don't have the right kind of insurance. The state will pay for it if you don't have insurance, but you got to go to certain places. And God help you, if you're underinsured, that's really hard. Then you have to go to one of these things called the Federally Qualified Health Centers. You got to locate one of those. So for people who have money and good health insurance that's covering this vaccine, you're set. You just take your daughter in, you're done. If you have a son you want vaccinated, you're on your own. If you're a parent who wants to vaccinate your daughter, or you know, you're a young woman who wants to get vaccinated, then it depends again. Are you rich? Do you have the money? Great. Do you have insurance? Great. If you are underinsured, you're going to have a bit of a hard time. But the key thing you want to look for is you look for something called a Federally Qualified Health Center, FQHC. Look for one of those. Those people can give you the vaccine. And then if you have no insurance at all, there's something called, at least for the 11 to 19-year-olds, I believe, there's something called the Vaccines for Children Program, VFC. The Vaccines for Children Program covers uninsured kids, and they should be able to get the vaccine free of charge. The law mandates that they be given the vaccine. The vaccine will be given free of charge. There is an administration fee that you'll have to pay. If you can't afford it, they still have to give you the vaccine, so make them give you the vaccine.
Right, and that is actually a program that provides, according to what I've got here, free vaccines to children and teens under 19 years of age who are either uninsured, Medicaid eligible, American Indian, or Alaska Native. That's available at over 45,000 sites across the country.
Yeah, it's an outstanding program. And you may recall recently this whole debate at the federal level about what we're going to do to take care of kids' health. And there was an override of a presidential veto. And this was some of the money that was involved is paying for this Vaccines for Children program.
I see. Yeah, well, we don't even want to get started on all that. That's a whole nother program right there, I think. My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Noel Brewer, who is an assistant professor of health behavior and health education at the UNC School of Public Health. Noel, you talked a little bit about how this HPV vaccination has been adopted in other countries. Does the cost present a barrier to adoption, particularly in the poorer countries?
Absolutely. That is the key issue. It is the number one issue. In America, we have about 10,000 women a year who get cervical cancer and about 4,000 women a year who die from it. That's a lot for a fully preventable disease, and that is something that we should remedy. It's down a lot from what it used to be. Pap smears are working. We're getting the word out there. Women are getting these done, and that's great. However, we're a rich country. We have a lot of health care resources. There are countries where that's not the case, and that's where all the rest of the HPV is. A lot of it's in Africa. And let me tell you, at $360, it's a non-starter.
Right.
There's no way that people in Botswana are going to be going out and getting this vaccine. It just doesn't. It will never be provided, unless they happen to be especially rich, and they'll probably actually leave the country and get it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Or alternatively, they might buy it from a healthcare provider there, and who knows what it'll cost. It might cost them $1,000.
Right. Those countries tend to have high rates of cervical cancer as
exactly
well?
Exactly so. So the cervical cancer, cervical cancer here in America, I don't remember the exact stats. It might be number 10 or number 7, but it's not in the top 5 cancers affecting women, and it's not in the top 10 cancers affecting sort of when you put women and men together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's relatively rare. However, there are many countries in the world where it is the number one killer.
This is
something that we should care. We should care a lot about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But given the current cost, it's impossible. So we're essentially developing we're developing an intervention that can help us as a rich country, but that cannot help the countries where it is most needed.
Which is all too often the case across the board. HIV/AIDS certainly being a prime example of that very model.
Yeah, and I think the HIV/AIDS model is a good one to think about, that activists have forced the drug companies to make the drugs available in Africa, and not quickly. It took a long time, and there are a lot of bruised egos and bruised knuckles along the way. Mm-hmm. I think the HPV vaccine is a great place to also get activists involved. However, there are also some other bits of good news along the way. There appear to be other vaccines being developed that may be less effective, meaning they're not 100% effective against these sort of narrow range, but they might be, say, 50% effective against a broad range of different kinds of HPV. And they also may be very inexpensive. That's what they're hoping for.
Okay.
If those vaccines are developed, these so-called, what we have is something called an L1 type, and these new ones are these L2 types. And I'll apologize to the epidemiologists and the biologists out there who actually know more about this than I do. But
sure.
This new type appears to be potentially less expensive, and that would be a great opportunity for Africa.
I see.
And other developing countries
where might that stand in the pipeline?
I don't understand the development process. I know that it looks really promising, but I'm going to guess 10 or 15 years down the road.
I see. Well, let's hope that will come about, because it sounds like, as you say, that cervical cancer being a completely preventable outcome, it sounds like we certainly need to be doing more to work on that.
We have to. I think it's a moral issue that I think as a country where this vaccine was developed, we need to take action on this.
I see. Well, Noel, we haven't yet talked about some of the studies you've been conducting regarding medical decision-making in relation to the HPV vaccine and other issues. And, you know, of course, one of the major points of the controversy and the reason, you know, we've all heard about this is the argument by some conservatives that the vaccination of young girls could result in promiscuity later in life, since they would theoretically feel protected. Even though that argument, to me at least, seems really pretty absurd, it's had some political impact in some areas, Texas being an example. Have you looked at that issue? And if so, what does the evidence show?
We've looked at it extensively. I mean, one of the things I like to point out is that the idea that there's a vaccine that you could give adolescent girls that would make them sexually promiscuous is a dream. It's sort of a fantasy that adolescent boys have had for years. Just take it to the doctor and bam, there you have it. I don't know. I mean, on the face of it, I'm really skeptical, and I think I approached my research with that sort of skepticism in mind. So I want to just lay that out there, that when you have someone who's a little less partial, you can sometimes come up with different answers. But I'll tell you the answers that we've come to.
Okay.
The first question is, who cares? About 6 to 12% of parents seem to be concerned that the HPV vaccine could cause sexual promiscuity, meaning they don't know that it will, but they're worried about it. Mm-hmm. And that's 6 to 12% of Americans. In a study we recently did in some rural areas in North Carolina here, we found the number was all the way up to 20%, which is a pretty good size number.
Sure.
So all those other 6 to 12% numbers were before the vaccine was available, but now it is available. Those concerns may have sort of become more salient, mm-hmm. Given that you're actually faced with a decision as opposed to it being a hypothetical. All right, so this is a minority opinion. It's a vocal minority at that. The next question, though, is that given that, and the other thing I'll throw in is that doctors, about 10% of physicians have this belief as well, so that they are concerned that it might cause sexual disinhibition. It doesn't seem to affect their decisions on whether or not they want to provide the vaccine to kids, but...
Really, I find that totally amazing that physicians would.
Yeah, and I mean, physicians
make that leap of logic.
Sure, but physicians are people too. They have the mm-hmm. same concerns, and they're in places where you just don't know. I mean, it's a fair question to ask. I think people even at the CDC wonder this. Anytime a new vaccine comes out or new preventive behavior, you worry. All right, well, we're gonna save some problem, you know, save some harm here, but maybe we'll cause more harm there. Mm-hmm. So this idea that providing some sort of protective precautionary behavior will cause other harm is called the risk compensation hypothesis, and it's been around for decades. And it's hotly debated in various fields. There's a really nice article in the New York Times summarizing this in the Freakonomics column, where they were talking about the research on driving. If you provide people with seatbelts, that all of a sudden they'll want to drive faster. So, so you get the gist of this, that seatbelts caused you to feel safer, but that you have some sort of a homeostatic resting rate of risk that you like to have. And if you don't have enough risk in one place, you go find it in another place. So then you start driving a little faster. The data on that are extremely mixed, and it's highly controversial. Mm-hmm. So it's suffice to say that we don't actually know for seatbelts, something that we know that you ought to do. Hands down, seatbelts save lives, as far as I know. The total number of dead Americans at the end of the year is fewer with seatbelts. But even that fact, which I think most people think of as like water's wet, things fall down kind of thing, that can be, you can make that controversial. Move to an area where you have something like vaccination, where there's many fewer studies, and the kind of data you need aren't really all that available. Oh man, it's wide open. The best I can give you in terms of our data are some data that we gathered about 5-6 years ago on the Lyme disease vaccination. And so the question here is, you get vaccinated against Lyme disease, does that cause you to suddenly feel safe and not protect yourself against a whole bunch of other things? Well, and you may be thinking, well, maybe that's not so bad. You know, you take precautions so that you can go and do other things. Like your kid's out there riding down the road on his bicycle, and you think, no way. Put the helmet on, then you can go out there. Mm-hmm. So you make the kids safe so they can go do something that's a little risky. That makes sense in a way. But with these vaccines, it's something a little bit different. With the HPV vaccine and also this Lyme disease vaccine, they're not 100% effective. They're partially effective. So if you have people who go and do other things that make them even riskier, you could actually end up with a net gain in their risk, their risk profile.
Sure.
And you end up with more people being harmed. All right, so let me back up again and get back to the story about Lyme disease. So what we did is we followed some people for a year and a half, and we looked at them before they got vaccinated against Lyme disease. Then we followed the whole cohort of them, and some of them got vaccinated. And the question is, did the people who got vaccinated suddenly feel less at risk? And the next question is, did that feeling less at risk cause them to engage in fewer protective behaviors? So the first question is yes, of course. People who got vaccinated started out feeling at higher risk to begin with. They were the people who felt the most at risk, and that caused them to go get vaccinated. But once they got vaccinated, they felt a lot less at risk for Lyme disease infection, which is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, less at risk for getting the Lyme disease. All right, so that's the good news. So they felt less at risk. That's great. But did that cause them to engage in fewer protective behaviors? Those protective behaviors are things like wearing long pants and long sleeve shirts and wearing a carotid and checking yourself for ticks. No. One behavior they did a little less often, I'm going to forget which one it is something about maybe wearing long sleeve shirts or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they did that a little less often than the people who didn't get vaccinated. But risk perception wasn't the reason. There may be some other reason that we don't really understand, but it certainly wasn't about risk perception. So at least in one study where we actually went and did all the work needed to find support for this risk compensation hypothesis, we didn't find it. But let's move over now specifically to HPV vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
For this to work, you have to have some pretty improbable things lining up. Number one, adolescent girls are going to have to believe that having sex causes cervical cancer. And I'm here to tell you that most women don't believe that. And certainly a 12-year-old girl, she's not going to believe that at all.
Well, whether they believe it or even understand it.
Indeed, all of that. So you'd have to have that to begin with.
Sure.
That they'd have to connect cervical cancer and sex. Number two, they'd have to believe the vaccine stops cervical cancer, which they may or may not believe. And then they would have to believe that that risk perception is something they could now spend by having extra sex. And that having extra sex then would raise their risk profile. It's kind of improbable. It's a bit of a just-so story for me. How I come down on it is that we know that a certain number of women every year get cervical cancer in America. For me, the certainty is cervical cancer. That's happening.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's uncertain is sexual disinhibition, the sort of becoming more sexually active as a result of vaccinating. And in my calculus, the way that I've come down thinking about this is that I worry about cervical cancer, and until I see better data, I don't worry about sexual disinhibition.
I see. This must be a very difficult question to conduct research on. I would think there'd be even a certain amount of bias involved in that people who would get vaccinated or have their daughters vaccinated would tend to be more health conscious and less likely inherently to engage in risky behaviors anyway, as opposed to the people we've been talking about who think that their daughters getting vaccinated will make them want to run out and audition for Girls Gone Wild or something.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, it's a funny joke, actually, Girls Gone Wild. But I mean, I think that's these parents who are concerned about sexual disinhibition, that's really what's on their mind. They really worry about their daughter. These are sincere concerns. I don't think, sure. I think they come out of sometimes ideological places, but the motivation behind them, I think, is sincere. And I think that that's one of the things that we should start thinking about is when we are engaging in these debates, that the people on the other side are often having very, very strongly held opinions that come from deep beliefs. The question, though, about the sexual disinhibition, whether this is a concern, I've actually come to think of this as being a risk factor. That parents who have this belief are at risk for not vaccinating their daughters. And rather than this being something that guides the national debate, concern about sexual disinhibition, I think the country has largely moved on, but I think the policymakers need to carefully move on as well to thinking instead about making sure that the parents who are concerned about sexual disinhibition are actually targeted for vaccination campaigns.
Well,
educational campaigns to at least get them some more information about what we do know, what we don't know, so they can make a fair decision.
Absolutely. Well, in researching for our discussion today, Noel, I discovered a point I hadn't considered previously that speaks to what we've been talking about, that approximately 88% of American children, as you mentioned earlier, are routinely vaccinated these days to prevent hepatitis B, which is a sexually transmitted disease, and they're vaccinated by the age of 19 months. And, of course, we never heard any controversy about that. You know, the article I was reading that discussed all this went on to speculate that HPV vaccine is such a hot button with some people is because it is recommended for girls aged 11 or 12 just as they're about to undergo puberty. Do you think that that is a particular factor, that there's some kind of Freudian need out there to, you know, protect our virgins or something?
Wow, that's a lot. I might speculate in a cocktail conversation about any number of things, but I think here I'm not going to. I do think that America's a little crazy about sex. And certainly once you talk about sex and teens, we just get irrational. And sex and teens and girls, it's just, it's off the charts. So I think that that this vaccine coincides with a bit of American craziness. I'll agree with you on that.
Mm-hmm.
Other countries don't have this sort of preoccupation about sex and moralistic concern about it. However, that is where we are. And if the company had introduced the vaccine in a different context, perhaps for both boys and girls, if they had waited a little longer so we could have done a younger age, I think certainly all those things are the case. I like the analogy that you made, though, to hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is an STD, and we already have a cancer vaccine. Hepatitis B causes liver cancer. So we've already been through this once before with no tears, no fuss, no problems over this. But this is a case where we didn't do as well. Now, one of the speculations that people who do this sort of policy work have made is that some religiously conservative organizations have had a particular objection to this because this vaccine will take away one of the main arguments about abstinence, that they've been able to say up till now that condoms don't fully protect you against STDs because condoms aren't fully effective against HPV. They largely protect you, but there's still a little bit that may get through, although that finding seems to be going away, that they seem to be pretty, properly used condoms seem to work pretty well. So that's the speculation that was happening at the time, that that a lot of this debate was sort of fired by some of these religious organizations. I think that may be right, but I don't really know. I mean, it's not my area of research. That was on the order of qualitative research that some colleagues have done.
I see. Well, tell me a little bit about your research. I read the paper you did in rural areas of North Carolina studying the uptake and what messages framing of the messages seemed most effective in getting the women to have their daughters vaccinated. Tell us about that.
Sure. We've done a whole bunch of studies, and let me tell you about a couple of them. In one of them, we examined what the best way was to talk about the vaccine. And it depended on whether the women were interested in vaccinating themselves or their daughters. So if you're interested in vaccinating a daughter, it was good to talk about the vaccine as being good against cervical cancer or genital warts. But about HPV didn't matter. Didn't really help all that much. However, when talking about to women about vaccinating themselves, it only really helped if you called it a cervical cancer vaccine. So the bottom line message seems to be, no matter what, call it a cervical cancer vaccine. And then if you are talking about vaccinating kids, you should also mention genital warts, if that's helpful. So that's one of our findings. The other is that we did a systematic review and then also some primary data collection as well, where we looked across the systematic review looked across a whole bunch of studies, 20, 30 studies, to try to find out what affects acceptability, willingness to get your daughter vaccinated. And it was the usual suspects. If you believe your daughter's at risk, is she likely to get the cervical cancer? If she got it, would it really be a dangerous thing for her health? Is the vaccine effective? That was a big concern. Are there side effects? And then also, would a doctor recommend it, or are there other sort of powerful people in your environment who say this is a good thing? And those are all the usual things that affect vaccination decisions. There's another thing, though, that seems to be playing a role that I'm particularly concerned about, and that's race. African-American moms are less likely to want to get their daughters vaccinated and less likely themselves to want to get vaccinated. This matters.
Sure.
The reason why...
Go ahead.
Yeah. The reason why it matters is that in America, there's a large difference in terms of who gets cervical cancer and dies from it. That is that African-American women are twice as likely to get, and well, they're a little bit more likely to get cervical cancer, but they're twice as likely to die from cervical cancer as white women. Now, we can talk about race and the social construction of it and what in the world does race mean anyway, and I'm down with all those arguments. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that women who self-report as being African-American are twice as likely to die from cervical cancer, and we should care about that. So number one, because they're more at risk, we should be pushing to make sure that they get this vaccine, but we're seeing the opposite, is that they're less inclined to get the vaccine for themselves and their daughters. And that was just in terms of their intentions to get it. And then we recently did a study. We just had this data, not been reported in the scientific literature yet. And we found that African-American women were slightly less likely to have gotten their daughters vaccinated. The difference is something like on the order of 12% to 9%. So maybe 9% of African-American moms had gotten their daughters vaccinated. 12% of white moms had gotten their daughters vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Now, small difference, 12%, 9%, who cares? What I care about is that we're going in the wrong direction. And if this trend isn't reversed, we'll probably see the usual trends where African-Americans are getting fewer health services and getting more sick as a result. Mm-hmm. And this is going to multiply the racial disparity. What I think is going to happen here, what I see, as I look in my crystal ball, we look down 5, 10, 20 years down the road, and all of a sudden we have the cervical cancer rate for whites has just sort of fallen through the floor. It's just disappeared. And then the one for African Americans is sort of slowly drifting down, but that the gap between the two has widened substantially.
Indeed.
So, activists out there, if you're listening, let's get access for African-American women. Let's get special programs. Let's get the word out there in African-American communities. If there are pastors out there, if you feel comfortable recommending this to people in your churches, do it. And if you don't, then at least make the information available. This matters. If you don't believe in the cervical cancer vaccine, then start advocating against for pap smears or other things, because this is something that's fully preventable. We can make a difference, and race is playing a large role in this disease in America.
Is that why minorities are characterized as one of the high-risk groups in this?
Absolutely, yeah.
And I understand that that's all also true. Poor people, people in rural areas, women in developing countries, and smokers are the other high-risk groups involved.
Yeah, exactly. So, and the reason why smokers... it's sort of a weird thing. You're smoking, you puff through your mouth and through you get into your lungs, and all of a sudden, how does it end up all the way down there? The biology of it is not something I understand, but it is one of the clear risk factors. Mm-hmm. There are a couple other sort of funny ones about pregnancy that we don't really understand, and it may be a statistical anomaly. Mm-hmm. Those are sort of debated right now, but the race one is very, very clear.
And the race one and the one with poor people and people in rural areas, women in development, it all sounds like barriers to access.
It is barriers to access. I mean, the race one's a little funny because it seems, at least the data, according to self-report, African-American women are slightly more likely to get pap smears than white women. And so maybe pap smears won't help. I mean, there are some cancers that just simply affect African-American women more and more dangerously. And so that's just a bit of bad luck, the way the biology goes. But, I mean, it's always hard to sort out. I mean, there's differences in whether you get it because of the pap smears. There's all these differences in terms of follow-up. So we don't know the difference between biology and then just sort of what I frankly think are racist differences in our medical care system. I mean, who knows? Mm-hmm. But the the point that you were making earlier, I think, is the right one, that there are real differences in services between rich and poor, between urban areas and rural areas, between people who are various ethnic minorities and people who are not. And we need to try to right some of that in order to sort out some of these disparities in who gets sick and who dies.
Do you see the results of your and your peers' research in these areas resulting in any impact in public health programs or new initiatives? Translating out?
Yeah, I sure hope so. I mean, I started off all of this as being a psychologist interested in medical decision making who does theoretical work and sort of sits in his office and does statistical analyses. But when I started seeing what some of these disparities look like and sort of this going in the wrong direction, it's getting me alarmed. And so the first paper that I'm going to write on this is going to be about these racial disparities. And I can tell you, it wasn't the first thing on my mind when I walked in. But once you start looking at what's going on, you start being, at least I started becoming very concerned.
Mm-hmm. And this is a concern that, translates out from the ivory tower out to the real world and life and death for real people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Dr. Noel Brewer, we are actually just about out of time, and I had all kinds of other questions prepared to talk about some of your other work, but we spent the full hour on HPV. There's so much to talk about there that maybe we can get back together at a later date and talk about some of the other very interesting work you've been involved with.
That's great. And I'd like to leave listeners with one comment. Mm-hmm. If you don't know where to get the vaccine, call your local health department. You can certainly call your physician, but you can call the health department. And the other thing is that although I personally would vaccinate my daughter, no question about that. That's a decision.
That was my last question you anticipated.
If I had a son or daughter, I'd do it tomorrow. I'd go find the money and I'd get it done.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a decision you'll have to make. And I think it's fair for parents to say that I'm trying to decide.
Sure. And if nothing else, parents should be proactive about getting the information to make the right decision.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Noel Brewer, thank you so much for being with us, and keep up the good work. And again, we will do it again another time.
Thanks much.
And we have many excellent guests coming up on Radio In Vivo over the coming weeks. We update the website, radioinvivo.net, constantly as the lineup solidifies and occasionally changes. So we hope you will join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. See you next time.